You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Sorry about the little mix-up, folks. The radio station began playing a rerun, and we weren't able to get through because apparently one of my little daughters had been playing with the telephone, and so we were unable to make the phone connection. But we're on the air now, and we will continue where we left off on Friday with Miles Gilbert's lecture on archaeology, ancient Indian cultures, their pictographs and petroglyphs. And then he's going to go into a talk on the old buffalo hunters of the Old West. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did at our annual conference on May the 28th, which is the date that Miles gave his infamous talk.
Identifying with fertility. And this one can be identified again as a member of the corn plant because it looks like an ear of corn, or others identify it as a butterfly symbol because of the antennae on the head. So what they've done is identified the mature butterfly head with the immature or a caterpillar body. Raven site is close by here. Raven site is a place where you can come and excavate. It's an extremely rich site. I guarantee that you will find a lot of fossils and bones if you care to come dig. And here's the floor of a pueblo with a stone lined firebox and a reflector stone. Just behind that is a ventilator. Fresh air would come in and hit that and go around either side and blow on the fire. There's a number of, well, there are 10 varieties of architecture at Raven site, and this one is like Phase 3 at Pueblo Bonito. The structure, since they didn't have rebar in those days, the structure is made of willow and pine, and then coated with mud. And here is Wupati National Monument up north of Flagstaff. This one, again, is a Pueblo 3 era site. This was abandoned when the volcanic eruption occurred in AD 1065-66, and then because the volcanic ash created a kind of mulch that preserved ground moisture, groundwater, people were able to come back and found that farming was much better than it had been before they left. And it looks like we're out of slides for that particular reel. This will give Bill a chance to get a machine reloaded and give you a chance to go out and take a break. And when you come back, we will have some more to say.
And that was the end of the tape, folks. We put another one in, and we'll bring it up momentarily.
Snowfall in the mountains, and it's a lot of minerals because it's filtered from volcanic
Just full of river. And the lower areas. Is the screen visible to you folks? Not too much light on it?
Looking good.
We're looking at the edge of the Coyote Hills Shield Volcano. The Coyote Hills erupted between 3 and 5 million years ago and covered an area about 35 square miles with a rather thick layer of basalt. And the ancestors of the Hopi and Zuni found a place near Springerville where there are 5-step terraces that slope down from the edge of the Coyote Hills Shield Volcano close by the Little Colorado River. So, Casabal Pais, which means House of the Badlands, is located right here on this series of 5-step terraces. And here again you can see the cliff, volcanic cover all the way over 35 square miles in, and we have the uppermost of 5 terraces. So there's 1 terrace, 2, 3, 4, and a 5th out of sight. I want to orient you from overhead to the architecture at Casabal Pais. Here on the left is a square kiva, in keeping with its ancestral Zuni origin. Casabal Pais itself is a series of about 60 contiguous ground floor rooms, an astronomical observatory with both equinox and solstice functions. This is 88 feet internally and 92 feet internally. And then in this area is a series of catacombs, underground rooms that were utilized for interment of the deceased. Here is a map showing, in addition to the kiva and the pueblo and the astronomical observatory, a number of walls and some other structures, some of which are enigmatic. That means we don't know what they were used for. This is what Casabal Pais may have looked like when people were living there, probably as much as 3 stories. A remarkable thing was that these folks were able to move very large boulders, and they created not only walls, but also a walkway. From up here, there's a nice flat walkway going down, 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 and across the boulder field. This site was visited by Frank Hamilton Cushing in 1883, and he led his horse across that walkway. Cushing was an archaeologist working for the Smithsonian Institution, and he lived with the Zuni from about 1878 to 1884. He became a Zuni to the extent that it was possible for an outsider to become an insider at Zuni. It no longer is. But he became a Zuni to the extent that he was inducted into the Zuni bow priesthood, which meant that he had to take an enemy scalp. He wrote to a relative that, fortunately for him, the Apache wars had started up again, and so he could shoot someone, really take an enemy scalp without breaking the law. They were, after all, at war. Well, here's the great kiva. A kiva, again, is a kind of a church, and it had a roof. The guys who built this had to go about 6 miles across the valley over the forest and cut trees and carry them back. They didn't have any beasts of burden at that time, and that time was specifically, construction was accomplished between AD 1240 and 1284. So in that 44-year period, everything that was here was built. So it had a roof, had a flat roof, and from this side, you can step right up on the roof and go over and go down a ladder to get inside, which is what you would do if you were reenacting the emergence of the ancestors. Otherwise, you'd use the east-facing doorway and go inside. Now, a kiva is a kind of a microcosm of Puebloan belief about their origin in the underworld. Over in this corner was a hole in the floor. There was a hole called the Sipaputi that represents the entrance to the first underground world. The floor of the kiva represents the second underground world. If you're a Zuni, the ladder that came out through the roof represents the third. But if you're that represents the third underground world. Now, being a square-cornered ancestral Zuni Kiva, this does have a bench across the back end. But notice that this bench is narrow compared to the bench on the side. There's one on the inside here and the bench in, across the front. These side and front benches, wider, are aftermarket additions, if you will, indicating the presence of the ancestors of the Hopi. So this is definitely an ancestral Zuni site. We know that because of the pottery. We know that because the Zuni took a cushion there. And we also know that there was a Hopi element because of the Kiva bench and some other factors. By the way, this room on the front is also enigmatic. When Cushing was here, it made a map, made a sketch of the Kiva. He does not show that room, nor does that room show up on Ned Danson's 1948 map. By the way, Ned Danson, archaeologist, father of Cheers, Ted Danson, worked here in 1948, became director of the Museum of Northern Arizona. So why is that room there? Well, I suspect that it's an aftermarket addition by shepherds post-1948. They probably pinned their sheep in the Kiva and built that for their own protection from the wind. Boy, did the wind howl up there. You've seen this slide before. Here again, we're Pueblo Benito. I just want to show you the circular Kiva of the ancestor of the Hopi, but the internal bench is an architectural feature of the Hopi Kiva. Also, the T-shaped doorway. This is a T-shaped doorway at Pueblo Benito in Chaco Canyon, and at Casamal Pais, there is a T-shaped doorway. By the way, we have three ring dates of AD 1260 on those two Douglas fir posts, so they've been there 738 years. So the floor would be here, and this little T-shaped doorway, and then the roof line would be right there. That's where the vigas or roof poles were, and then a wall above that. So this structure was at least two stories, possibly three. This is what the site looked like when I went to work on December 18th, 1995. We have Pueblo dwellings, we have the Astronomical Observatory, we have the White Mountains in the background, we have the Valley of Little Colorado in the foreground. This area was probably farmed, corn, beans, and squash, of course. And you know that the corn and beans and squash were all put together so that the broad squash leaves would shade the area. They wouldn't lose moisture to evaporation so quickly. The corn stalk would serve as a pole for the bean vine to wrap around. And neither corn nor beans by themselves are completely all you need in a diet. There's a synergistic effect in eating the two together. This is Fajada Butte over at Pueblo Benito in Chaco Canyon, and it is the site of the first discovered Hantu astronomical function here in the southwest. Behind these big boulders, there is a petroglyph right there, and if you can see it, there is a dagger of light going through the middle of the petroglyph, and lo and behold, the petroglyph is a spiral. And again, the spirals are associated with emergence, they're associated with migration, and they're also associated with completion and carrying on. The idea here is that the seasons will continue. There was ritual magic done here, and this dagger marks summer solstice. So this shaft of light is here on June the 21st. At winter solstice, the dagger appears at the edge. It's actually split. There's one here and one over there at winter solstice. Now, this is neither a Hopi nor a Zuni structure. This of course, is a Mayan structure down at Chichen Itza. Before I became an archaeologist, my mother went to Chichen Itza. She was so excited to come back and tell her son that she'd been to Chichen Itza. At any rate, this is also a summer solstice phenomenon, and as the sun sets, it casts light and shadow down and gives you the effect of a rippling snake and here's the head of the snake rider. So that's a phenomenon that occurs on summer solstice. Meanwhile, back at Casamal Pais, here's a rough sketch of what happens. At winter solstice sunset, the sun sets in a notch at full null, and that's 15 miles from where this is located. So the winter solstice setting sun casts a shaft of light from there through the south gate and then through the east gate and lands on a bear paw petroglyph. According to the Sunni, evidently the first sun priest or shaman at Casamal Pais was a member of the bear clan. At winter solstice sunrise, the light comes across this southeast gate and hits the inside of the west wall, where there is an altar of stone built on the inside of the wall. By equinox, the sun is further north in the sky. It's moved from here to over there. So at sunrise, it comes through that gate, and now it goes out through this south gate. We videotaped that this last year. By the way, these four gates are not over 2 feet wide, but this one is 4 feet wide by virtue of these two walls being deliberately offset. So that's actually 4 feet across there. And this wall stays in shadow all the time through the course of the year. In the middle of the south wall is a massive foundation stone, and that lines up with this gate and gives us a true north light. And almost directly perpendicular then is the west gate and the east gate. They're almost exactly perpendicular from the true north and the south line. Well, here's the actual observatory. And another interesting thing that happens at equinox sunrise, which is near the time of, this would be spring equinox, near the time of the summer harvest, of the first harvest, as the sun rises, it casts a shadow from the southeast gate through the west gate. And what we have here is half of it in shadow and half of it in light. And this recreates the path of blessing. The path of blessing would be along this margin, the path of blessing on the floor of a Hopi altar. Okay, let's look at the winter solstice phenomenon. The sun sets in that notch on full moon and casts light through the 4 foot wide south gate, through this east gate. And by the way, the space between this boulder and one over here is only about 14 inches. So it's very tricky the way the light comes through here and lands on the bear paw petroglyph. It was so overcast that winter solstice, I wasn't sure that the line of shadow was going to show up, so I put a piece of tape there. I wasn't even sure that my camera was going to catch the bear paw, so I put a piece of tape there. You can see this is not very dramatically different between light and shadow. But here we have the shaft of light that hits the bear paw petroglyph at sunset on winter solstice. As I mentioned, it was overcast. It was also very cold. Here's my colleague, Terry Lee, bundled up for winter solstice sunset. Now, here's our buddy, the spiral again, and this one is located where a shadow is cast on it at spring cross-quarter day. Now, as the name implies, there are four cross-quarter days. A cross-quarter day is a day exactly midway between solstice and equinox, or equinox and solstice. The Hopi, of course, believe that they are emerged from the underground, and the spiral represents then their emergence up through the Sea Pampuni. Notice that this is one of those that is a clockwise spiral rather than a counterclockwise spiral. And also there's a footprint associated with it, again indicating emergence and then migration away from the Sea Pampuni, or place of origin. As the sun sets on spring cross-quarter day, which would have been May 6th this year, we get this diagonal shadow across here. 24 hours later, the shadow is a whole ring over to the right. So it's a very sensitive spring cross-quarter day marker, and that's important because this is when the people would have begun to plant corn, beans, and squash. They would have prepared the ground prior to that time, but they would plant then beginning at spring cross-quarter day. And it's also important because it's over, they had a month and a half to get ready for summer solstice. The belief is that the Casima spirits are in the villages from about winter to about summer solstice. There's a whole lot more ritual activity, more dances and things going on this time of year than is between winter and summer solstice than there is from summer to winter solstice. So we've got a month and a half to get ready for saying goodbye to the Cosima spirits. For the Hopi, they return to their home at the San Francisco Peaks over by Flagstaff. And for the Zuni, they return to their home in the Mud Lake, northwest of St. John's, Arizona. Well, I regret that this slide is not better, but it's important. Here is a spiral. It's a big spiral, and it's connected to a small spiral that's there in the shadow. And this pair of spirals is bisected by this shadow at noon on summer solstice. According to informants, this pair of spirals indicates that people left here in Casamal Bayes and then went to a new location, probably Ravenside, which is only a few miles north. Now, both Hopi and Zuni have parrot plants, macaws, which were traded from Cochabamba, Mexico. And according to the Hopi and Zuni both, this represents a kind of a stylized parrot. He's flying to our right, obviously a Republican parrot. Anyway, you're still asleep out there, aren't you? Or you don't care. According to the Zuni, he is spitting rainwater down onto this figure, which I thought was a big horn sheep, but Hopi and Zuni both say that they do not, and their ancestors did not, represent animals in full face. Animals are represented in profiles, like the parrot is a profile, side view. This is not a big horn sheep, nor is it a devil's claw. It is actually a corn plant, simple, very stylized corn plant symbol. So the parrot is spitting water onto the corn. And below that is a human-like figure, and it has a knob on its head. These are stylized representations of the butterfly hair spools of young women prior to marriage. The Hopi women wore their hair in a bun, big buns on the sides of their head. Very industrious young woman, evidently. Also, ladies and gentlemen, when I was showing the slides of the Pueblo, I mentioned that the women own all the property. Fair enough, they built the Pueblos, or at least they did the masonry. At least they did the mud mortar and the plastering. I assume that the men carried the heavy rocks and brought the roof poles, but the women did the masonry. I have three independent photographic documents verifying that from the last century. William Henry Jackson at Old Arrivee in the late 1870s, and Clark Broman on the Hopi Mesas in 1895, and then an unidentified photographer at Laguna Pueblo showing the women doing the masonry. Now, what about these dudes? We've put on the board that we have both anthropomorphs and zoomorphs, and you can read those either way or both ways. First of all, these are identified as lizard clan, or they're identified as the ancestral beings before they got to the above ground fourth world. They were not fully human, but they still had tails like polywogs. In other words, they show metamorphosis from one level of existence to another level. A really important zoomorph is the centipede, and he's important because he represents a spirit messenger from the below ground world to the above ground world and back. Casamal Bayes is built of basalt, but a mile away is a limestone quarry, and a lot of limestone was quarried there and brought over. Limestone is important because it has a flat cleaving plane and can be made into a number of useful things like beach stove tops. Think about frying your pancakes on a griddle. That's essentially what a peaky bread stove top is. And also, you can make good matates out of a number of other things. Here we have a view at Ravenside close by. And sandstone is used there to make kneeling bins, M-E-A-L, kneeling bins, where the matati and the mano, the matati is the big stone that corn is ground on, and the mano is the handheld stone that you would use back and forth to grind up your corn kernel. And then the sandstone blocks serve as a box to contain the corn meal as it's generated. And why have three of them? Well, you start out with your corn kernels and put those on a very rough, coarse stone, and grind that into rough meal and pass it over to the next stone where you get a finer grind and pass it over to the last stone where you end up with corn meal that you can make your tacos and tortillas and stuff out of. Also, this is where a lot of education was done. Three women, three generations typically, would be working here, and their grandmother would pass on information to mom and granddaughter. Like so, this is a stone vine firebox. We encountered a circular structure at Casamal Pais. Elsewhere, circular structures gave access to underground rooms, such as were used for ritual. This circular structure had some really whacking big boulders in it, and I enlisted the aid of these guys from the Agave House chapter of the Arizona Archaeological Society. This was a mechanic, and he brought over this collapsible A-frame and a pulley outfit, so we were able to get these big rocks out of there. And we did indeed find then access to underground rooms. I've been asked if I have ever had a sense of presence of anybody at the site. And I said, well, yeah, one time I did get a glimpse of Indiana Jones, but just a glimpse. Okay, before we put on the next slide, Trey, let me see if anybody has a question or comment about anything pertinent to Hopi or Zuni or other. Yes, sir.
Was there anything unusual about that room? Or was that storage? Or what was
the
room?
The circular room underneath? Yes. There are other underground structures. There's about 3 acres of underground passage in Casamal Pais, and one of those contains a really wonderful bright yellow pictograph of a Native American. Others contain burials, but all of the burials that I know anything about were systematically burgled beginning about 1960. But the real answer to your question is, when Cushing was at Casamal Pais, he drew a sketch map showing 3 underground fissures, 2 of which I have encountered in excavation. I have found underground rooms below the living area, Pueblo, and I suspected that this circular structure was going to give access to the north end of the westernmost underground fissure. We've accessed the south end of that underground fissure and found that there was an altar there. It was definitely an underground altar. And access out of it to the north was blocked by a constructed masonry wall. Well, I could not hold the wall, but I generated a lot of bad press with Hopi and Zuni. So rather than do that, I just thought, well, let's see if we can get in from the north end. And what I need, do I have a volunteer? I need a slender person, preferably a short, slender person, to get down. Yes, ma'am. You want to do that? All right, we'll loan you a hard hat. Okay, well, I'm going to change the reels here. Variety of physical situations, and you want to pay attention to the physical situation because the first rule of petroglyph understanding is to correctly identify it. If you misidentify a petroglyph, I absolutely guarantee you're going to misinterpret the petroglyph. So context is part of understanding what it is and why it is where it is. So here's a little Colorado, and why would people be interested in that? Well, none of us can live without water, so we're going to find petroglyphs that indicate how to get to water. And notice this human figure here way down canyon, and here's a massive flat sand stock rock we're going to look at in a few minutes because it has a panel of pictographs, which again are painted figures. Most of what we have to show you this afternoon are petroglyphs, which are scratched or pecked through the desert varnish on rocks. There was a lot of ceremony that took place in this area, and this is immediately upstream on Little Colorado from the Raven site and immediately downstream from Casamal Pais. I mentioned the castle was occupied, or at least was actually built from 1240 to 1284, and then people left there about 1400. And I showed you a pair of petroglyph spirals, which have been interpreted by Hopi and Zuni as migration from Casa somewhere. Well, we know that there was a lot of interchange between Cozumel Mice and Raven site. And one of the things that both groups of people may have done was to share this pathway of stone. Actually, it's a kind of a rite of passage place, and there are two of these. There's one that runs north-south, and I found another one just a little bit south of here that runs east-west. So the point of all this general area was used for a great deal of ritual activity. Here is a shrine or an altar, if you wish. This area right here, the nice flat area, overhung by that big boulder. And when we first found this, there were, sacrificial offerings that had been left there in the form of little stones that were poured into this area, pieces of turquoise, crystal, that kind of thing. So, here we have an altar with a lot of petroglyphs on it, and we're going to have some close-ups of these as we go along. Another physical situation in which you find petroglyphs is the tops sometimes of rocks. If you were walking along down there, you'd never see these. So, if you're out on a petroglyph hunt, you want to look at the tops of things as well as the sides of things. And this slide, at least this panel you've seen before, you remember your old lady, the Venus or sand clam figure, and the Cassina mask, the snake footprints, and so forth. Now, we're back to Big Flat Rock. That's Jim Kunkel, who runs Raven's site, and he is looking at a panel of pictographs, and it's none too soon to bring your attention. Jim is the author of this book titled Stone Magic of the Ancients, and the subtitle is Petroglyphs, Shamanic Shrine Sites, and Ancient Ritual. And it's an absolutely marvelous book. It covers all the kinds of petroglyphs that are in this part of the world. And I brought a whole box of these, so you can buy one if you want to. They're also available from almost any National Parks and Monuments Association supported a national park or monument. For a buck and a quarter, you can have rock art symbols in the southwest or easy field guide to southwestern petroglyphs, and these are worth far more than the dollar and a quarter they cost. I regret that I don't have a bunch of those. I've got a whole box full of Jim Kunkel's book, though. So, meanwhile, having put in a plug for Kunkel, we can get back to a slideshow here. Now, again, these are pictographs, which are painted images, and they are of the style that we associate with the archaic period, and it's remarkable that they are well preserved, being painted images out here in the open. They're very definitely geometrics, and they're of the archaic that would be prior to the birth of Christ, anywhere from 5,000 years ago to about AD 400, somewhere along in there. That would be archaic period. We refer to these as fire track symbols. And the archaic people used a number of styles, but they were very heavily into these geometrics. And I regret to inform you, this is one of many petroglyphs that I would not pretend to interpret. Now this one's easy. And this brings me to the point of how do we know how old is it? How old is it? Well, the first thing, we look at the patina on the rock, and we see if the petroglyph has begun to repatinate. Is there a chemical change taking place in the petroglyph? And yes, you can see that this one is older than this one. This one is very fresh. Now let's look at the styles. This is definitely, to use a generic term, an Anasazi style. This is ancestral Hopi or Zuni. And this is very definitely an Athabascan speaking, probably either Apache or Navajo. So the Apache or Navajo has come and superimposed their spirit figure over that one. In fact, they grabbed hold of the ancient one with the modern one. And so this guy will now have all of the power, all of the ritual of power and importance of the antique petroglyph. By the way, these guys, Apache and Navajo, didn't get out here in the southwest until about AD 1500. you noticed throughout the afternoon that I put AD before the date. In newspapers or other literature, you will often see dates like Columbus got here in 1492 AD. Well, just because it's in print doesn't mean it's right. The professional way to put a date is Caesar. Julius Caesar was killed March 15th, 44 B.C., and this is A.D. 1998. So B.C. dates go before B.C. Anno Domini dates come after Anno Domini, okay? Just so you know the right way to do it. All right, another way that we can determine how old a petroglyph is to not only look at the relative repatination of the thing, but let's look at lichen growth over in the Colorado Front Range, the rhizocarpon attains a growth of about 3 inches in 100 years. Here in the Southwest, it's much slower. The Colorado Front Range, even though it's in the rain shadow of the Rockies, gets a lot more moisture than we typically get out here in the Southwest. So here is a spiral petroglyph. It would have to date somewhere between probably AD 950 and 1400, somewhere along in there. And another spiral. Again, these can represent emergence from below ground to the above ground, or it can be a planned boundary marker, or it can be a migration glyph. And this specific one we've seen previously, here we have a spring marker. Those of you who look at topographic maps recognize that we have a very similar symbol now for springs on topographic maps. We have a circle with a little wiggly line coming out of it. And so this indicates a location of a spring. This one also marks the location of a spring, and here we have our emergence or migration glyph, traveling glyph, and the waving line for water, or you can interpret as a snake, which is also associated with water, and this one is definitely a spring location marker. We're going to talk about Copacabana in a few minutes, but I want you to get a good look at what's going on here. Here is a human-like figure, because he has a bow and arrow, and yet he is covered with, he has a coyote or a wolf mask on, and he has the skin of another one. There's the animal's ear and its nose and its legs hanging down. He's got the skin of another one draped over his back. This is a wonderful means of getting up close to herd animals like buffalo or antelope. They know, buffalo animals know that, that a coyote or a wolf cannot run down a healthy animal. And so if you're a Native American hunting those, you can skulk along covered with the skin of that animal and get within bow and arrow range. Okay, Copacabana. Now, as I mentioned earlier, this guy is associated with the katydid, the humpback insect. He has antennae, or another interpretation for him is as a peddler, where he is carrying trade goods like parrots or seashells or whatever. And he's also a fertility symbol with his erect penis, and the idea is that he then carries seeds to plant. Usually, Copacabana is found facing to the right, as he is on this panel. By the way, there are a number of other interesting animals and figures here. This one with long tail is identified as a mountain lion. And this would be a shamanic figure itself, very large hands. Well, he's out of his mind, I guess, is one interpretation. And this is not just an Anglo interpretation, but a Native American interpretation. His thoughts are all over the place. Well, here's Jim Kopel looking at one of the few Copacabanas that is a left-facing Copacabana. And here he is again. The flute, very faint, his arms and flute, and his erect penis. Sometimes knobby knees are interpreted as signs of dis-ease, and also the hump back has been interpreted by medical people as exhibiting Pott's disease, a kind of bony degeneration as a result of tuberculosis. And tuberculosis is definitely a new world disease, as is syphilis. By the way, syphilis is not found in Europe until after Columbus and the guys got back home. It is caused by spirochete, Treponema pallidum, and it was very prevalent in the American Southeast. We find prehistoric Indian skeletons with all of the signs of tertiary syphilis, that is, they have Hutchinson's teeth, lines of arrested growth in the teeth and in the long bones, the syphilitic lesions on the forehead, and the sacred shin, that is the sword-shaped lower leg, the tibia. So those are both New World diseases that were taken back to Europe. So another interpretation of this is that we have Pott's disease or tuberculosis going on with this guy. Hello. Sometimes petroglyphs are found singly by themselves, and sometimes in panels. You've seen this guy before. This is our little quasi-corn plant assembled down here all by itself, and you have to wonder why it was put there. Well, it was associated with a dragonfly character, and again, not far from a spring. But it's entirely possible that a corn plant person came by here and simply put this to indicate the passage of the corn plant. I know for a fact that when Hopi and Zuni make their migrations to Zuni Salt Lake or over to the Colorado River, down the canyon of the Lower Colorado to the original Sipapuni, the place of origin, and then on beyond that to the salt mines in the valley of the Grand Canyon. As those people pass by a rock like this that has their clan symbol on it, they will either add a new one or freshen an old one, simply marking their passage, their pilgrimage by there. And these guys, again, you remember either Two Horn Society or Antelope Clan and the Corn Clan, or a shamanic figure, depending on who you ask, Hopi or Zuni. And we're back at this panel, and I wanted to point out, if I can find it, I'm going to have to look for it on another panel.
The dollar sign?
Yeah,
right. His shirt sleeve for the Rebel Jesus.
Up in here?
Come down.
This is actually an anthropomorph. There's his head and his two arms and his tail coming down. Yeah. Sometimes this is identified as the turkey clan. And a great surprise to me was the interpretation by Farrell Sakakuku, recently Hopi tribal chairman. Farrell is a member of the snake clan, and he says that his clan considers their totem animal, their snake, to have had legs and feet, so it was really more of a dinosaur or a lizard-like animal, a bipedal lizard, than a legless snake as we think of it. So he would identify this with snake clan rather than turkey clan. When an anthropomorph is found with its arms up, it is said to be in a praying or blessing stance. And this one appears to have a tail like a Mesoamerican monkey. Okay. Here again we have, this can represent a trail or can represent a snake. But oftentimes we will find a trail like this associated with footprints, in which case it would indicate direction. And here we have the emergence, the trail of the centipede. This is clearly a trail, and this part is clearly a centipede. So he's coming from below ground to the above ground and is carrying a message. And here's another very stylized centipede. I think this one has 9. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Well, I've got 8 levels there. The typical emergence story has to do with coming to this fourth world, the fourth level of existence, but there are others that have more involved, more than just four. And here's another stylized centipede, again, a spirit messenger. And this figure would have to do with bringing rain. It is a human-like figure standing over a rain cloud, not to be confused with a true thunderbird, which is also associated with bringing rain. And we have quadrupeds. I mentioned on the board that some of the animals are represented are definitely game animals. You will see here that they have split feet, hooves. It's a hoofed animal, possibly an antelope. Antelope are usually identifiable by virtue of the geometric designs on them. Or you can think of this as having a dark front part of the body and a white back part of the body, a white rump.
Why is the compass on there? Get a compass up?
Yeah, when we do these photographs, we like to know which way true north is, and to get an idea of the scale of the petroglyph. We're trying to see if there's consistency in direction of travel of the animals or direction of what side of the rock the petroglyph is put on. So that's why we have the compass on there. And we're back to this guy. A much better view now of this figure with the bow and arrow. Here's the bow, here's the arrow, and here's the hunter with his coyote or wolf cap on and the animal skin hung over his back. Another mountain lion, always identified by having very, very long tail. And a mountain lion footprint. I was privileged to see a mountain lion footprint fresh in the sand when I was over by this site. It was a big thrill to have this antique mountain lion footprint and a fresh one from the bottom. Okay, this is a symbol I was looking for. I mentioned earlier that looked to me like a kernel of corn, but there are those, and this from Hopi and Zuni, that this represents female genitalia. And the footprint, and this one is interesting from the point of view that this is a natural concavity in the rock, and then it was adapted by putting toes on it to make a really big footprint. And here's another view of the six-toed dude, example of polydactyly. And I think the most remarkable footprint of all is this one, which began life as a footprint and then has been adapted aftermarket to make a human being, probably a shaman figure. There's good evidence that the shamans were able to accomplish their task by virtue of ingestion of hallucinogens, and here in the southwest, the two that are most readily available are the peyote cactus, local for Williamsine, and the Datura inoxia, sacred Datura, or some of us think of as morning glories. But these shamans, then, when they would take on these hallucinogenic drugs, would be able to travel out of body, so they say. And so they're represented then as human beings and in a traveling stance or spirit migration with their arms up, kind of floating. And here's another one. Very big heads. Sometimes these are interpreted as tails or male genitalia either way. And often then we find panels with a number of figures. These birds may represent game animals. Certainly we would think of these as game animals. But a figure with really big hands and big feet is thought of as a creator being. Here's one that is deliberately put in an upside-down position. Notice our Thunderbird is right side up, and yet this creator being or spirit being is upside down. This thing is interestingly identified variously as the larval form of a what we call an antlion. That would be a tiger beetle, family Tigrinidae, a tiger beetle larva, antlion. It's also thought of as a scorpion. So here's the scorpion's tail and its pincers up front. This you can think of as the sun or a tobacco flower, again, a spiral. And a really remarkable panel over here we'll try to get a closer look at. First, our scorpion or tiger beetle, or antlion. Now, look at this guy. Here's definitely a shaman. He's got a buffalo headdress on. He's got big pendant feathers, perhaps, coming off of his headdress. And he's associated with another sort of antlion looking thing that has very big hands and feet. And these are identified then as creator gods. They're able to accomplish, they're able to do things. and here then a sun or a tobacco flower. And likewise, here's an emergence glyph which shows the direction of travel. When the people came up from the underworld, they were told to go all four directions from the Sea of Puni, and so oftentimes we will find those directions of travel associated with the spiral. And here again, we can think of this as a tobacco flower. Now, Kunkel is showing us one of the very few geometrics that we can identify as being a pattern, a symbol that we find on pottery and on weavings. And here again, this is the Baki clan, the cloud house or water clan symbol. It's very, very old. And here we have a complex being with the geometric pattern. His arms are up. Maybe he's a travel or a spiritual travel stance. Very definitely not just a normal human being. I mentioned to somebody that the paho or prayer stick is manufactured by men. If a woman wants to offer a prayer stick, she will pay a man to make one. And holders typically about so big, they might be made of Berberis fremontii, the plant that we call warberry. The Zuni are divided into 14 clans, and one of those is the Yellowwood clan. And if you take a warberry and shave the bark off underneath the bark, the cambium, what we call the cambium layer, is bright yellow. So they call themselves warberry. And the berries produce a kind of a Welch's grape juice color juice. And these Yellowwood clan guys will smear themselves all over with that juice. So the Yellowwood guys become purple. Okay, but to get back to the papa or the prayer stick, the prayer stick then will be carved and it will have tied to it first an eagle feather and then a duck feather and then whatever other feather is appropriate for this particular prayer that's going to be offered. It's kind of like burning a candle, I suppose. You take this prayer stick to the shrine, to the altar, and you offer it then with your prayer. And the idea is then that if you give the spirit this offering, then you're more likely to have success with your prayer. So this petroglyph represents a paho, a prayer stick with feather attached. And here is a guy with a paho in hand. And he's also got a headdress, a couple of antennae or horns. He might be a two-horned society person with the prayer stick. This panel is down along the Little Colorado, just west of Eager. This is easily accessible, and this figure is identical to one that I found underground at Casamal Pais, associated with the bright yellow pictograph. We have this guy in bright red underground, and he is, again, a two-horned deity person. And above him is Masao. This represents the Hopi god of death.
That's it for today, folks. We'll pick up where we left off today, tomorrow. Hope you'll join us. Our special guest today on the Hour of the Time was Miles Gilbert. He actually gave this talk on May the 28th, 1998, at our annual conference at the Thunder Horse Ranch. Tune in again tomorrow for the Hour of the Time, and we will continue with Miles Davis' lecture on ancient cultures, pictographs, pictograms, and eventually he's going to get into a very, very good talk on, not to say that this isn't, but a good talk on the ancient, the old buffalo hunters of the Old West. Again, we apologize for the late intro to the hour of the time. One of my two small daughters had evidently been playing with one of the telephone extensions in the house, and we went a little nuts trying to figure out why we couldn't make the phone work to link up to the satellite and WRMI, Worldwide Shortwave Radio. Again, please accept our apologies. You're listening to 101.1 FM Eager, classic radio, like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM Eager is your nonprofit community service radio station.